You're listening to EcoScience, the lectures from the 34th Professor Harry Messel International Science School, held at the University of Sydney in July 2007. For more information, go to www.scienceschool.usyd.edu.au.
Can humans just adapt to climate change, or must we continue to work to reduce it? These are some of the issues confronted by Princeton climate expert Dr. Michael Oppenheimer in two lectures delivered in Australia in early July 2007. It was part of the International Science School series. This is the second part of the lecture, How Warm is Too Warm?
So, yesterday I forwarded the proposition, essentially, that governments might actually be more effective at reducing emissions of the greenhouse gases and avoiding as much of the climate problem as they possibly can, rather than relying on adaptation, given that our recent experiences with adapting to severe climate events, extreme events, have been much less than successful. And I pointed in particular to the European heat wave of 2003, Hurricane Katrina. You could probably think of other climate events that are more close to home, wherever you come from, for which the same story goes. So I also try to present a framework for how one might think about solving the problem. And it's kind of a top-down framework. One would need to look at the full suite of potential impacts of climate change, such as we know them, and decide which of those are really, really bad, which of them have really negative impacts, and therefore are worth avoiding, and then work backwards. Ask what level of warming might bring about a risk of that impact, what greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere, or levels of water in the bathtub, if you will, bring about those temperature changes. And then what emissions scenarios, what sets of emissions of greenhouse gases could be implemented that would avoid that level of greenhouse gas concentration, or what drip from the faucet could avoid that level of water in the bathtub, so to speak. And we should always be fully cognizant that there are lots and lots of uncertainties. We do not fully understand how sensitive the climate is to the buildup of greenhouse gas emissions. We do not fully understand exactly, if we have a given emissions scenario in the future, how much of the gas will actually stay in the atmosphere, because there are uncertainties about how forests will respond and absorb carbon dioxide in photosynthesis. There are uncertainties about how the oceans will respond. And perhaps most of all, we do not fully understand the impacts that occur in a particular region from a particular global temperature change. Now, I'm going to put some flesh on the bones of that general framework today by speaking of one category of impact that could be reasonably, plausibly labeled as dangerous, and that is a substantial rise in the level of the seas, the level of the ocean, due to a significant loss in the amount of ice in either the Greenland or Antarctic ice sheet. And it is a level of warming, a level of impact that's frequently pointed to by governments, by environmental advocates, and by scientists as having potentially very dangerous, very sweeping impacts. Now, there is a legal framework that I pointed to yesterday for thinking about how one could implement those kinds of emissions reductions that would be designed to avoid any particular level of concentration which is deemed dangerous. And the framework for doing so was developed in 1992, as I pointed out, and it's called the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC. And it's under Article 2 of that agreement. And this is, by the way, an international treaty. It's a treaty that that Australia is a party to, unlike the Kyoto Protocol. It is a treaty that the U.S. is a party to, unlike the Kyoto Protocol. It does not have binding emissions obligations in it, and it was anticipated that the progeny of this agreement, in other words, further protocols designed under this treaty, in particular the Kyoto Protocol was the first one, would implement those binding emissions reductions. And in fact, that's happening in some countries. Europe is moving ahead to implement those emissions reductions. Some countries in Europe have had success, like Germany, the Netherlands, the UK, Denmark. Others have not had much success, Spain, Portugal, Greece, for instance, in meeting their emissions obligations. But the general framework is going to survive whether the Kyoto Protocol turns out to be a complete success or a partial success or a failure, and we'll only know that in retrospect. This parent of the Kyoto Protocol will still be around when the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012, and the next set of agreements, which are already the subject of negotiation among countries, including the U.S. and Australia, will probably be designed as a grandchild of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. What that means legally is that all the things that were true as obligations in the UN Framework Convention, including avoid this injunction to avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system, will become the objective not just of Kyoto, but of this, whatever follows after Kyoto, this next agreement, which may not be called Kyoto 2. They will probably try to abolish the name Kyoto in order that politicians can save face going back into a climate regime without admitting that they maybe shouldn't have pulled out in the first place. So I'm going to look at one category of change that could be labeled dangerous, a large sea level rise. But before we do that, this really has to be done from both a science and a policy point of view. So we're going to look at what the history of global sea level rise has been. After all, it gives us some measure of our ability to adapt to sea level rise if we understand what we've been experiencing in the recent past. And we then have to project how fast we think sea level may rise in the future without a significant ice sheet contribution, and then with a significant contribution from the ice sheets, to try to understand what our choices are and truly how dangerous this may be. This is the crummiest slide I own, and I'm sorry, but the original that I stole it from is even worse. But I'll try to get you to understand this. This is the date. 18,000 years ago was roughly the last glacial maximum. You remember from the graph yesterday the ups and downs of climate. At this point, ice sheets were very widespread in the northern hemisphere and covered some of the mountain areas of the southern hemisphere much more extensively than today. This is today here, or at least recent times. And this curve is derived from a variety of data. And it shows exactly what you'd expect as the major ice sheets retracted after their maximum 18,000 years ago, the sea level started to rise. Why? Because all that water that's bound up in ice has to go somewhere, so it goes into the ocean, and that rises the level of the sea. And in fact, global sea level was about, 70 or 80 meters lower when the ice sheets were at their greatest extent. So we had some very rapid periods of very rapid sea level rise up until around here, which is around 10,000 years ago, and then the curve starts gradually to level off as all the ice except the remaining relatively small ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland, Antarctica not being so small, but in the northern hemisphere, Greenland, were all that was left. And it's important to note two things. First of all, civilization, as we know, it starts around here, around 10,000 years ago. And that's when we first got fixed settlement, agriculture, societies being dependent on being able to stay in a particular place for more than whatever a nomadic society would stay in it for. In other words, for many years. And, in the case of some fixed settlement now, it's been thousands of years. And that's the first time that settlement would actually have to deal with the issue of rising seas, because before that they could always sort of move back over a time scale which was very quick compared to how quickly the seas could rise. And we see that so that as civilization developed, it developed during a period not only of relatively moderate climate, but when the sea level was at, the rate of sea level rise was actually decreasing. Now, there is this tangent to the curve here. That measures the present rate of sea level rise, and it's projected from the last few points on this graph. And you'll note that the slope of the sea level rise curve recently, which is just really this last piece here, is higher than the slope at the very end of the curve, which shows a regression from the last glaciation. And that's because the rate of sea level rise in the last 150 years or so has sped up by a factor of about 10 compared to the mean, the average, over the period of the last 2,000 years after the glaciers had given up the ghost. So we have already seen an acceleration in sea level rise due in large part to global warming, which is about, brings us to a rate of sea level rise maybe as much as 10 times what was experienced in the whole history of civilization. Why is that happening? There are three general reasons why sea level rises as the world warms. Number one, water, like most fluids, will expand when you heat it. Number two, mountain glaciers are retracting almost uniformly worldwide. The only place really over the long term where mountain glaciers are not yet receding is the center of Antarctica and the center of Greenland. And the reason is it's much too cold in the center of Antarctica, even in a warmer world, for those glaciers to melt yet. And number two, in Greenland, there's actually more precipitation probably coming about due to the fact that the atmosphere is moister due to the extra evaporation from the ocean. So that these two reasons combined have contributed probably 85% of the enhanced rate of sea level rise over the last 100 or 150 years. But then, as we'll see later, there has been a shrinkage at the fringes of Greenland and Antarctica, which is now starting to make a significant contribution. And the key question for us today is how fast can that shrinkage go in the future? We know we're measuring the sea level rise for about 100 years using flotation devices called tide gauges, which were not uniformly distributed around the ocean surface, so we didn't have measurements everywhere, and they weren't necessarily accurate. But starting in the early 1990s, we started collecting data from satellites, which use lasers to measure very accurately the height of the ocean surface, and we've developed a very accurate picture of the rate of sea level rise. And this is what it looks like. There's a lot of year-to-year variability because, for instance, one reason is temperatures vary from year to year. But over the long term, you see there's been a continuous trend as long as we have that data now, which is about 15 years. And in fact, this trend, this rate of sea level rise, is higher than what was measured from the tide gauges. And it looks like sea level is now increasing at a rate about 3 millimeters per year, which may not sound like a lot, but it starts to add up. So that, let me give you an example. If you, over the last 100 years, the sea level has risen about 20 centimeters. If you ask, well, how much beach does that take away? Because after all, if the sea level rises this much, the beach is sloped inland very gradually at most places. You actually eat up a lot of beach, a lot more beach than the vertical sea level rise, due to erosion and due to just submergence of the beach. And it turns out there's a factor of 100 in conversion that you have to use to convert roughly on a sandy sloping beach, as you have maybe in western, around here too. There's about a factor of 100 between the rate of vertical sea level rise and the amount of beach that's taken away. And that you can figure it out for yourself. That's quite a lot of beach that's been eaten up worldwide in the last 100 years as the world has warmed. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change broke down the contributions this way. They reckoned that they did it in two clumps from 1961 to 2003, and then the more recent trend available from the satellite data. There are two things interesting about this. As I said before, the glacial melt and thermal expansion are causing most of the trend, which is, again, 3 millimeters per year, as you see here. But there's now a significant contribution from Greenland and Antarctica, about 15% of the total. And I want you to keep your eye on that, because the interesting thing about that is that from 1961 to 2003, the average over that period was for the ice sheet contribution was actually quite a bit smaller. It was essentially zero for Antarctica. That is, the uncertainties were bigger than the inferred trend. And for Greenland, it was certainly close to zero in both cases. So the signal of the loss of ice from the ice sheets has all of a sudden come out of the noise of natural background variation, the static, like on radio static. All of a sudden, we see a noticeable contribution from the ice sheets, which was not seen for the longer period. And that is troubling because it indicates that, in fact, the ice sheets are accelerating in their march into the sea. But there are other factors that affect sea level rise locally. If you looked in Sydney, if you looked in Cairns, if you looked in the Perth area, if you looked in Bangladesh, if you looked in New York, you would actually not see the global mean, because at any one location on Earth, there are other factors that affect the rate of sea level rise. Sediments are supplied to the coastline by rivers, and that can add or subtract, the changes in sediment supply can add or subtract the height of the sea bottom, which affects sea level rise. The Earth is still rebounding from the effects of having been weighed down by glaciers, by huge glaciers during the last glacial maximum. And as the Earth, which isn't rigid, which does bounce, as the ice was unloaded, the Earth started to move back as the water that was in the ice got redistributed around the globe. And that effect affects the height of the sea bottom relative to the continental, the positions of the continents, and that contributes to sea level rise. And then in any one place along the coast, the interaction of the tectonic plates can affect sea level rise, can affect the local height of sea level. And then there are shifts in ocean currents from time to time, which can affect sea level. So there are many local factors, and you can't look at any one location and believe, for instance, that it reflects what's happening everywhere. And I show you that in this graph. Look at the top figure. The red indicates high rates of sea level rise, and the blue indicates areas where sea level actually seems to be lowering. And you can see that while on the whole, the Earth, if you average the reds and the blues, is a pretty clear trend to higher sea level rise, there are places where, say, because the ocean is cooling off a little bit, going against the global trend, where sea level may actually be falling. So you need to keep it in mind. And when you look at any one position on Earth, you may not get a number that's the same as the global average. Sea level rise has caused problems already. This is not a question of something that's going to happen in the future and where problems will happen in the future. Human beings are already challenged by the fact that the sea level is rising. There's erosion and submergence of beaches, wetlands, and wetlands are, of course, important to the health of marine fisheries, and other lowlands. In a country like Bangladesh, which is essentially a river delta and agricultural lowland, where they're losing land in some areas hand over fist to the rising seas. And that cuts into people's livelihoods. Structures are undermined. Infrastructure disappears. Groundwater, which is a source of drinking water, of course, gets salinated as the sea level rises and pushes salt water into fresh water, and agricultural soils experience the same effect. And then some Pacific islands, some atolls, are under the threat of complete loss eventually due to sea level rise, places like Tuvalu, for instance, and they are already suffering substantial percentage land losses in some cases. And then a threat that's a little harder to understand is the episodic threat from storms. If you think of what a storm does, it drives the sea level in, it drives the sea into the coastal region, so you get flooding, you get water arriving at places where people live and they don't expect the water to be. That's what a flood is. Well, as the sea level rises, the distance inland that a storm can push the ocean surface is further and further inland. So the sea starts arriving at your front door, and you've never seen it there before. What do? You run. So that episodic threat, which is sometimes numerically indicated in terms of the 100-year flood level, that is, what flood level does a storm that comes up every 100 years create? Those flood levels start to return more and more frequently. So what used to be the 100-year flood level eventually becomes the 50-year, the 30-year, the 20-year. Then all of a sudden, almost every year, you might be getting a 100-year flood. That's what we expect may happen in the future. Bangladesh is a worse case because It's got a very high population density, a very constrained area. It's, as I said, a river delta. People have low incomes. All the agriculture is near or at sea level, or in some cases almost below it. There's an overtaxed river system, the Ganges, from which withdrawals, actually the Ganges, Meghna, and the Brahmaputra, the three big ones, withdrawals from those rivers are causing further sinking of the delta. The region is subject to tropical storms, which do create these flood lines that I just talked about a moment ago. And, of course, there are some unique ecosystems in that area, particularly the Sundarbans, which are home to a substantial reserve of Bengal tigers. So if you want to look at all the problems, and by the way, the stippling is the population density. And the way to think of the threat here is that this area is the 1 meter sea level line. And the combination of natural settling and growth of the sea level due to global warming, even if you assume the ice sheets are going to stay in place, will cause this whole area probably to be underwater essentially a century from now. And there are 10 million people that live in that area. Where are they going to go? There's high vulnerability in industrial countries, too. We've got all the figure I showed you at the end of the day yesterday, the end of the lecture, I think, is a very telling one. Atlantic City, New Jersey, my favorite horror story. Housing, highways, infrastructure, beaches, wetlands, everything, right at sea level. And in the U.S., this one city that's actually below sea level, or in the case of the Netherlands, a whole country that's largely below sea level. These are very, very expensive vulnerabilities, and they put a high premium on trying to keep the rate of sea level rise down. And to show you how mindless we can be, I say we, I blame governments, I blame individuals. I give you this one story, which may not mean a lot to you, but I bet this stuff like this happens around here. This is in New York, it's near where I live, this West Hampton Beach. It's a barrier island, just a strip of sand. And these houses, you see them here, they wound up in the water after a big storm in 1992, which was the 100-year flood line. And the storm blew a channel in the barrier island. So if you go back there today, you know what you see? You see the barrier island's been put back. These homes, not the very homes, but homes exist all up and down this strip. The federal government of the United States went in and paid to have that done. Why? Because the people who live there are politically influential. And they gave them a 30-year guarantee so that if their homes get wiped out again, which seems almost inevitable because of sea level rise, we, meaning me, will pay to have their homes restored. That's the kind of nuttiness in terms of what coastal management looks like in my country. Is it any better here? I don't know. Do you know? Okay. There are adaptations that can be accomplished to minimize the damage due to sea level rise. We can withdraw, and that is being done in certain areas. We can raise infrastructure. You can build houses on stilts, and that is being done in certain areas. Agriculture can move. Beaches, well, you can pour sand on beaches up to a point. Of course, you run out of sources of good sand eventually. Seawalls can be built, but seawalls protect what's right behind them for a while, but they actually have the effect of robbing sand from neighboring areas, seawalls in what are called groins or jetties. And also, seawalls aren't permanent. They get undermined. So as the sea level rises, storms progress, it will undermine a seawall, and they're very expensive, and you have to rebuild them eventually. They're not permanent, really. And if you build a seawall, you lose the beach in front of the seawall because of erosion. All this costs a lot of money, and the net effect is it won't be done everywhere. And some people's coastline, a lot of money will probably go into trying to save some people's coastline, and nothing will be spent to save other coastlines in other areas. For instance, there really isn't much you can do in a country like Bangladesh. You can't build a seawall across the head of the Bay of Bengal. So what they did is they built very effective warning systems. So in 1970, a cyclone came along and killed what's reckoned at about 1 million people by drowning in Bangladesh, one of the worst natural disasters ever. And since then, they've got a lot better at dealing with these storms. They've built cement blockhouses, which are raised on stilts to which people can converge when the storm is anticipated. There are better warning systems. So now, when a storm comes along, generally the death rates are in the range of a couple of hundred to a couple of thousand. Still not great, but a lot better than 1 million So what's the what is the so that's the vulnerability. What's the future? The IPCC projected that the range of future sea level rise, depending on how, what you think emissions are going to do, and of course this all assumes we're not going to do anything to reduce emissions, ranges from about 0.2 meters to 0.6 meters global average. And again, that may not sound like a lot, but if you look at a place like Bangladesh or if you look at a beach here, again, you multiply that by a factor of 100 and you get some notion about how much land can be taken away. So it's a rather substantial effect. It would be it will be expensive to deal with it. But the key thing is to note the caveat, which the IPCC sort of buried here. But this all assumes that the ice sheets are not going to accelerate and cause a further substantial contribution to sea level rise. And that seems, it's plausible, but it's equally plausible that the ice sheets are going to continue to pick up speed and dump more and more ice into the ocean, causing an enhanced contribution to sea level rise. By the way, let me just show you, because again, I live here, Manhattan, you've heard of it. I live right around there. If one of the ice sheets disintegrates, I have beachfront property, which I'm not entirely displeased with, I suppose, because it'll be very valuable. But I just wanted to point out that the 100-year storm, I did this because this has the airports. And have any of you ever flown into New York? Okay. Anybody fly into Newark Airport? Okay. So Newark Airport is right here. It's one of the three big airports, two big international airports in New York. It is within, it's in the gray area here. It's within the 100-year floodplain. So in 1992, this was shut down for several days because of the big northeast storm that brought the flooding up. Well, that storm now will become, if we just let this go on and don't try to limit climate change, that storm becomes an event that happens more and more frequently, practically every year toward the end of the century. Then there are somewhat more minor flooding events. But the point is, these gray areas are the areas of the city that are vulnerable, like right along the west side of Manhattan here, very, very valuable property, vulnerable to repeated flooding as sea level rises. And just I want to show you that one of the airports lies totally within the flooding zone. Again, I wish I had those maps for this area, but I could not find them. So I apologize for being parochial. It's the best I can do. But the big unknown is the future of the ice sheets. All those estimates I gave are based on assuming the ice sheets more or less stay in place. So what is an ice sheet? If you go to one of the cold continents, being Greenland or Antarctica, it snows, right? What happens when it snows? Here's a continent. The snow piles up in the middle. Think of it like pouring pancake batter on a griddle. Under its own weight, that pile of snow turned to ice starts to spread towards the edges. And when it reaches the edges of the continent, it's near the ocean, and it's warmer than in the center of the continent. So you have melting toward the edges. Also, pieces of ice can break off and form icebergs and float away into the ocean. So the tendency, a general rule is, most of the accumulation occurs toward the inland part of these ice sheets, and most of the loss of ice occurs, of course, around the periphery. Ice piles up in the center, moves under the effect of gravity towards the edges, where it either melts or turns into icebergs. Melting is slow, in general, in the center where it's very cold. And in fact, the center of Antarctica doesn't have any melting. But at the fringes, the ice is right by the ocean. Temperatures are warmer. Some of the ice is actually floating over the ocean. That's called an ice shelf. And it's touching the warm water. And therefore, there's a melting process that goes on. And some of that ice can break off from one of those ice shelves. Again, an ice shelf is when that ice, the pancake creeps towards the ocean. Some of it forms a lip over the ocean, if this is the ocean water. And it can either break off into an iceberg or touches the ocean water and melts. That floating part here, that lip, is called an ice shelf. This movement toward the sea can be slow, and until very recently it was thought it was always slow, or it can be fast. And the trouble we're finding today is that we seem to be in a situation where we're finding more and more areas of the ice sheets that can move fast. And those areas seem to be the very areas that are affected by global warming. So it seems that global warming has two effects on the ice sheets. One, of course, increases melting, but maybe more important, actually lubricates the ice, lets the ice move faster into the ocean. And that's the trouble. And the threat is very, very large. The 10% of the Antarctic ice sheet volume called West Antarctica contains an equivalent of about 5 meters of sea level rise.
You are listening to Dr. Michael Oppenheimer's lecture, How Warm is Too Warm, Part 2, delivered in Australia in July 2007.
The 90% called East Antarctica, as I said yesterday, it contains about 60 meters. I don't think we need to worry about this. Most of it, not all of it, most of it is probably stable. But for my mind, 5 meters is enough to have to worry about. That's a lot of sea level rise. And Greenland contains about 7 meters. So between this Greenland and this part of Antarctica, we have a potential for 12 meters of sea level rise. And the question is, what temperature could bring that about? And how fast could it happen? This is why you often hear the ice sheets invoked as an example of dangerous anthropogenic interference. No one could figure out what we would do in response to a 12-meter sea level rise. Again, being parochial, this is a part of my country some of you may be familiar with. Americans like Australia because you turn America upside down, it looks like you have Australia. Well, one of the points is Florida, of course, the state of Florida, famous for its relatively warm climate. This is what happens if the Greenland ice sheet disappears. This is Florida today. This is if both the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheet disappear. And this is if the East Antarctic ice sheet also disappears. This isn't going to happen. But right here, just even this one, you've heard of Miami? The city of Miami and the 4 million people that live in the area, it would be gone. I mean, it wouldn't happen overnight. It's not like a big wave coming. But it happens gradually. The people have to move out and go somewhere else, and the infrastructure is lost. Or along the U.S. Gulf Coast, you've heard of New Orleans. There's another place you've heard of, Houston, probably. Well, you know, this dark green area is what would happen if both the Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheet were to disappear, plus if you add in the contribution from glaciers and thermal expansion. Just these are huge, huge land areas. Now, I wish I had this picture for Australia and for all the other countries that you come from. I don't have them. Some of it is available on the web, and you can check it out. I could not find one for Australia. So now we want to get back. Well, we do see this extra speeding up of the ice sheets. Why has this happened? Can you really show that it's due to the buildup of the greenhouse gases? A preliminary answer is some of it is, and some of it you can't prove it, but we're suspicious. What's the prognosis? How fast might the ice sheet start to disintegrate if we let the world warm? And what temperature is the really dangerous one? In other words, we're seeing some fraying away the ice sheets at the edges now, but when does it really become an unstoppable, irreversible process that leads to anywhere up to 12 meters of sea level rise? Those are the questions I'm going to answer for you now. Well, I'm not going to answer them definitively, believe me. I'm going to propose some directions to think about. So why are the ice sheets shrinking? Well, interesting thing is they're shrinking mostly not because of melting, as I said. They're shrinking because they're moving faster towards the sea. And this is a particular surprise in the case of Antarctica, because Antarctica, it was thought, would grow for some period of time because it was expected that extra precipitation would result from the warmer atmosphere and the evaporation off the ocean surface, and that some of this would be dumped in Antarctica, and that the increase in precipitation in the beginning of global warming, at least the first few centuries, would outrun any extra loss to the sea. But that's not what's happening. Antarctica is losing ice faster than it's gaining precipitation. Greenland, it was always thought, would in fact just sort of continuously melt away, but that it would be such a slow process, thousands and thousands of years, that we wouldn't be able to notice it, not within this century. In fact, both those suppositions turn out to be wrong. This shows you the extent of surface melting that occurs on the Greenland ice sheet. This is as it was in 1992, the orange area. Or pink, I'm not sure what you want to call that color. And this is, as it is in more recent years, the area in which melt occurs has extended to encompass a big chunk of the ice sheet, about 40%. And this is concomitant with a warming that's occurred over the period. And more than that, you still can't account for all the sea level rise from Greenland just by looking at this extension of the melt zone. What you have to also account for is some of the ice at the periphery is moving faster into the sea. I'm going to keep repeating that because it's very important. These are called dynamical losses. This shows you how do we know this. There's a very intricate, I just am always flabbergasted by the ability of scientists to do research in areas that are prohibitively difficult, daunting, and expensive to go to, even with slender resources from governments. This shows the trajectories of airplane pathways. Airplanes fly over the ice sheet. They carry a combination of instruments, some radar, some laser detection, which measures sort of like a GPS system to measure the height of the ice sheet. More recently, there's been some laser detection from space, laser altimetry, and a beautiful instrument called GRACE, which is really gravity recovery. I can't remember the rest of it, but it's two satellites that are flying in tandem. And as they fly near a big mass like Greenland, the difference in the satellite trajectories, how those trajectories change, actually can be used to measure the size of the mass of the ice on Greenland because of the extra gravitational pull. So if you do that enough times, you can measure trends, and the trends have been measured. And these are these numbers are what the earlier numbers I gave you for total ice sheet loss are based on. Rather remarkable. But it's very complicated because in Greenland, although we have seen some increase or substantial acceleration in glaciers near the coast, some of these glaciers sometimes accelerate and then slow down. And so it's complicated. We don't know. That's why it's hard to project into the future. We don't know whether the current losses are going to continue. But we do know, whether you look at the acceleration side or the deceleration side, acceleration here, deceleration here, that these ice sheets are capable of moving much, much, much faster, maybe 10 times, maybe 100 times faster in some cases than we previously thought. So it just underscores our almost total ignorance about what makes an ice sheet move. And that's a big source of uncertainty in this whole business that needs to be straightened out. One speculation in Greenland is that ice is melting from the surface and then falling in what are really waterfalls, they call moulins, to the base. And the water, when it hits the base, forms a lubricant, you know, because the ice isn't really frozen to the bedrock. When the water hits the base, it forms a lubricating layer, which can actually allow the ice to slip faster. So this is one theory about why Greenland seems to be moving faster than previously thought. There are other ideas as well. In Antarctica, there are two areas that are losing ice. They're the two blue areas here, this one and this one. I'll refer to this later as the Amundsen Sea Area, and I'll refer to this later as the Antarctic Peninsula. This is losing ice because there's an ice shelf that goes over over the ocean, and there's very warm water coming up from the bottom there, and that's causing the ice shelves to melt and the ice to accelerate into the ocean. This area is because it's warm, the Antarctic Peninsula, this is sticks up towards the bottom of South America. This is the warmest part of Antarctica, and it's warm enough so that summer temperatures get above freezing now that the world is warmed, and that is causing a fast ice loss there. There are two other features of Antarctica I'd like to show you. I talked to you a minute ago about ice shelves. There are two very big ice shelves, this one called the Filchnerani ice shelf and this one called the Ross ice shelf. Let's locate. This is South America, is up here, and Australia would be around here somewhere, although I should have put it on the map, but I can't pinpoint it. These ice shelves are fed by rivers of ice, and here are these rivers of ice. This is this area blown up. These are called ice streams, and they're moving very, very fast. This is a fairly recent discovery, maybe 30 years ago, and it indicates that you can only understand the balance of Antarctica if you understand that there are these rivers of ice dumping ice very quickly onto the Ross Ice Shelf. And the question arose, does the Ross Ice Shelf, because it's jammed along the coast here, actually keep the rivers from moving faster? What if global warming warms the sea under the Ross Ice Shelf and causes the ice shelf to collapse? Will these rivers drain much faster into the ocean, thereby unloading the entirety of West Antarctica, either this way or through the other ice shelf, because there are ice streams over here too, into the ocean? That's the key research question. There's another area here, which I pointed to before, the Amundsen Sea area, where that process already seems to be underway. Warm water, ice shelf being melted by the warm water, the ice streams in back of the ice shelf accelerating. This is an ice stream. Again, it's a river of ice. Here's the ice shelf here. Here's the inland ice. You can see it looks just like a river. These are the river banks, only instead of being dirt, there's solid ice that's not moving anywhere. And between these ridges of solid, slow ice, you have this very fast river moving. So the key question is global warming going to speed up the flow of these rivers of ice or ice streams? And the reason that's important is because the ice streams, which are these yellow things here, actually reach far back into the very center of Antarctica, of West Antarctica. That's the blue. These are called tributaries. So if the ice shelf, which is here, is collapsed by global warming and the ice streams start to move fast, they will pull ice, it is believed, from the very center of West Antarctica into the ocean, and that will be the doom of the West Antarctic ice sheet and 6 meters of sea level rise. Yes?
You say that the ice streams are moving fast. How fast?
1 kilometer per year or more in some cases. That may sound glacial to you to make a pun of it, but it's very, very fast. Those ridges of ice that I pointed to before are moving maybe 0.03 kilometers per year. So it's very fast ice. There are some glaciers in Greenland that are moving 8 or 10 kilometers a year. And you can calculate it yourself. If all the ice in Greenland were moving that fast, it would only take a couple of hundred years to unload the whole thing into the ocean. This is a schematic of the hypothesis I just made. Here's the ice shelf. Well, here's the inland ice, the ice stream. Here's where it gets to the coast. It jams up against rocks on the bottom or sides of the coast, and that keeps the ice shelf from moving and jams all this ice here. A theory proposed 40 years ago said that what if global warming melted these ice shelves, this would just run into the ocean. But it's only recently that we actually got a test to see whether that theory is correct. And I'll show you in a minute what that was. In order to understand whether, you know, how these ice sheets will behave in the future, you can only do it, the best way to do it would be if we had a computer model of ice sheets, but we don't. We do have computer models of ice sheets, but they're lousy. They do not reproduce the current behavior of ice sheets, so we can't use them to tell us what to do about the future. So what do you do instead? Okay, one is, alternative number one, there was a natural experiment performed. The hypothesis, if an ice shelf melts, the ice behind it will run into the sea. That's the hypothesis. Most people actually didn't believe that until fairly recently. It was just the hypothesis made 40 years ago by a scientist named Mercer. But we recently got a natural experiment that in fact showed that Mercer was right. This is called the Larsen Ice Shelf. It has parts A and B. And it sits on the west coast of on the east coast of the Antarctic Peninsula. So what happened is starting in 1996, this ice shelf started to melt. And then in 2002, it collapsed catastrophically. This area here is about, let me see if I can get it right, maybe 40. I'm not going to get it in terms of, I don't know. It's like 100 kilometers squared, something like that. It's pretty big. Not 100 square kilometers, like 10,000 square kilometers, something like that, 100 kilometers on each side. You can see these dark areas on the surface. Those are ponds of meltwater. They occur because in the summer, this place actually starts to melt because it's the warmest part of Antarctica. But it still maintained its solid shape. It was losing little pieces over here, icebergs. This photo was taken from a satellite in about February 15th, 2002. This is what it looked like on March 7th, 3 weeks later. Open ocean. Like a mirror of glass, a piece of pane of glass just being dropped. Look at that. Solid ice shelf, open water. Solid ice shelf, open water. That's one of the quickest, on a large scale, it's hard to think of a natural phenomena that moves that quickly. What was interesting then is to ask, well, here's the ice streams or glaciers behind the ice shelf. What did they do? That's the natural experiment. If Mercer was right, they would have accelerated towards the ocean and caused a contribution to sea level rise. If the skeptics were right, they would have stayed in place. What happened is very interesting. The glaciers behind the part of the Larsen Ice Shelf that collapsed, that's these here, all accelerated toward the ocean, sometimes picking up their speeds by a factor of 10. The ones that were behind the piece that didn't break off down here stayed put and did not accelerate, proving pretty well that Mercer's original hypothesis was correct, and that if you knock off an ice shelf, the ice shelf is holding the ice in back of it onto land, and the ice will start to accelerate toward the ocean. That is not good news, because eventually, if we let the global warming experiment proceed, the two big ice shelves around Antarctica, the Filchner-Ronne and the Ross, will become vulnerable. Now, this thing in itself here is not causing a gigantic sea level rise, because it's on the Antarctic Peninsula, and even if you lost all the ice on the Antarctic Peninsula, you would not raise global sea level very much. It's detectable, but not by any means catastrophic. But we are having an accelerated rate of sea level rise due to that change. There are two ways to destroy an ice shelf, as I think I mentioned. If you destroy it by surface melting, it requires a global warming of about 5 degrees Celsius. We could get that amount of warming by the end of this century. We may or may not. In any event, it's quite a bit of warming. It's still avoidable, in my view. But there's another process called basomelting, as I talked about before, in which the ocean water under the ice shelves warms up. That appears to be a much closer threshold. Even a little bit of global warming could cause that process to start melting these ice shelves. And in fact, the Amundsen Sea area, the little embayment I pointed to before, the ice shelves there are already melting away, and they hold back about a meter and a half of global sea level rise. And we simply don't know how far that process can go. In other words, I cannot convince myself that we are not already committed to a meter and a half of sea level rise. I don't know that we're not. What I am fairly well convinced of is that we have at least a couple of degrees breathing room before we're committed to the other 3.5 meters of sea level rise that the West Antarctic ice sheet could eventually contribute. And I want to point, so that's way number one to say something about the future of the ice sheets. Method number two is to look at the past, what's called paleoclimate proxies. And I bring evidence from the past. I bring it to you again from yesterday. This time, which is the last interglacial period, the last warm period, also called the Eemian period, the poles were 2 to 5 degrees warmer than today. So and sea level was 4 to 6 meters higher, presumably because parts of Greenland and West Antarctica had already floated away into the sea. So the question you want to ask yourself is, how much future global warming would make the poles as warm as they were in this period and bring about the complete loss, at least a partial loss of those two ice sheets? And that's a question we can answer. Here's another piece of paleoclimate evidence. The colored areas tell us how much of ice was on Greenland at the height of that last interglacial. Well, there was a big chunk of ice in the middle, and we think there was a chunk of ice down here. We know this by looking at ice cores. But a lot of the parts around the fringes and in this basin here were gone. And from that data, you can reckon that Greenland contributed at least 2 meters, perhaps as much as 3.5 meters, to global sea level rise of 4 to 6 meters during the Eemian period, which means that the West Antarctic ice sheet probably contributed 2 or 3 meters also. So what I think is if you bring polar temperatures back to somewhere between 2 and 5 degrees Celsius warmer than today, you're going to have a sea level rise with a contribution from both of those ice sheets of the order of 4, 5, 6 meters. And this slide summarizes that evidence. So the question we won't need to go through that. The question you really need to ask yourself is, how much warmer would it have to get to make the poles 2 to 5 degrees warmer? The answer is roughly something like a 2 to 4 degree global warming would do it. And I think the threshold, therefore, different people have different opinions on this, the threshold for losing big chunks of those ice sheets is somewhere in the 2 to 4 degrees Celsius range, which, if you look at the graphs I showed you yesterday, mean that we could lock in that kind of warming somewhere toward the middle or end of this century by our actions today. Now, the ice sheets wouldn't collapse overnight. Even though they move faster than we thought they were going to move, they still move relatively slowly. We do not have a good model to tell us how fast they would move, and the estimates range from a few centuries to a few millennia. And it's a matter of your own personal judgment as to whether that's a big risk or not. You know, if 4 or 5 meters of sea level rise were to happen in the course of a few centuries, I would say that would be a devastating outcome, one we couldn't deal with. If they were happening a few millennia, I think there would be time to withdraw. It's a gamble. The latest information suggests things are moving faster than we thought, but we still don't know enough to know which end of that spectrum we're going to get. My view is the safest thing to do would be to stay away from this temperature range, period. So you start then being able to build up a notion of what dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system is. It starts to me to look like anything greater than about a 2-degree warming, you get into a danger zone. And that's part of the information that led to the Europeans to pick a target of 2 degrees. So the IPCC, putting all this information together in its most recent report, came down to this statement. There's medium confidence, in other words, 50-50, that at least a partial deglaciation of the Greenland ice sheet and possibly the West Antarctic ice sheet would occur over a period of time ranging from centuries to millennia for a global average temperature increase of 1 to 4 degrees Celsius. Now, the reason it's 1 to 4 degrees here is the models, which I personally distrust, indicate that this process could start at as low as 1 degree. So if you want to be really precautionary, you want to avoid even a 1 degree warming. But I frankly don't think that's possible, so I don't even like to emphasize it, causing a contribution to sea level rise of 4 to 6 meters. That's where we stand. It's rather ugly, but it's what we have in front of us. So a plausible definition of dangerous anthropogenic interference is that it lies somewhere between a warming of 1 to 4 degrees, and we should be doing our best. We should use our utmost, our best, most focused science to try to narrow that range so that policymakers have better guidance. That's a very big range. But if you want to make decisions today and you want to be precautionary, you would say that a warming somewhere in the range of 1 to 2 degrees is too much. Then you have to ask yourself the question, can we avoid that level of warming? It's not entirely clear. These are the two targets. This is the target, the sort of 2-degree target that I proposed based on the paleoclimate evidence. This is the model-based target, would be about 1 degree. And being as this much warming is already committed, it's very hard to see how we're going to meet that range. The Europeans have suggested this as a reasonable target, but it's not clear that we're going to be able to get there. I think there's a much better chance we could avoid this target. And then, you know, basically we have to hope that it works and that the ice sheets are somewhat less sensitive than the greatest sensitivity they may have. And just to conclude, it should be pointed out the IPCC did analyze what emissions futures we may have and how expensive it would be to have stringent emissions reductions and to avoid that sort of warming. And this is not a very good figure, so I urge you to look at the IPCC report from whence it came to interpret it yourself. But the basic meaning is this. These are future emissions trajectories that would avoid a warming of 1 or 2 degrees. And there are two sets of them here. And basically, you know, if this is today's emissions, you can only allow a slight increase in global emissions before starting to bring emissions down in either case here. So what this tells us, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty. There are big ranges of uncertainty. We don't know exactly what the ice sheets are doing. But the best argument that can be mustered today is that a relatively small warming could be quite dangerous, and that global emissions as a whole, there isn't a lot of room for global emissions to grow if you want to avoid that kind of 1 to 2 degree range. And that the industrialized, so what I conclude from that is the industrialized countries have to get their act together pretty quickly to start making serious emissions reductions in a way that's convincing to the developing countries, so that there might be some kind of engagement between developing countries and industrialized countries, which would eventually lead to a serious global regime for keeping emissions from in more in this range rather than climbing into this range, where I think you can be quite confident that the ice sheets will disintegrate. Thank you, and we have about 20, 25 minutes for questions.
That was Dr. Michael Oppenheimer in Australia in July of 2007 as part of the International Science School series. Part 1 of the speech, How Warm is Too Warm, is available from the Radio EcoShock climate pages at ecoshock.org and from the Science School at scienceschool.usyd.edu.au/podcast. I'll say that again, scienceschool.usyd.edu.au/podcast.